All right, here we are.
It's the third week, isn't it?
Yeah,
but it's really, we're still on topic two. So for anyone who's following this, the first topic went on for 2 weeks. So I've already released the reading for next week, but then removed it again. So if you're getting a bit confused, it's all right. So the Bortoff reading, for those of you who are following me very keenly, I removed it. And I'll be putting it up after the class for next week, assuming we get through the Gilchrist. So there is a kind of a progression here. As you may remember, I decided we should do McGilchrist because he sheds another perspective on what Maturana and Verdenzola had to say. Broadens out. He does broaden it out, but he also introduces a more kind of conventional understanding of how the brain works. Even though he's not, hi Boris. Even though he's not mainstream, but he's a well-respected member of the medical establishment, if you like. But at the end of the last class, we were. I started off on. You know, we were discussing man and woman, and I think at the back of my mind, I guess what I was looking at was this vexed question of whether there is something essentially male and essentially female, and my own sense that in our culture at the moment, that is becoming something that to suggest that is almost considered to be prejudice. And there's an idea in the air, I think, that your gender is something that isn't genetically determined. And I don't know the answer to this question. Obviously, you're genetically determined in terms of your physical body, what your gender is. What gender is, in terms of how you are within, the gender you feel yourself to be, I'm just not qualified to talk about that. Just not qualified to talk about that.
Well, sociologists make a big distinction between sex and gender.
Yes,
they say that sex is biologically determined and gender is socially determined.
Yes.
So they make a distinction between male and female, which is sex, and masculine and feminine, which is gender.
Yes.
And they say that gender is socially constructed, because to say, like, for example, wearing makeup is feminine, is something which is relative to a particular culture. So, for instance, in 18th century England, wearing makeup was something that men did.
Got all that. When I say I'm not qualified to say, it's not that I don't know all that.
Yeah.
I'm not qualified to say what's at the deeper level is true.
It's funny because in Egypt, the men, they use makeup. It can be nice to understand why they were changing to don't use. Did you see?
Yes.
3,000 years ago, men were using makeup. That you are explaining that if you use makeup, it's like feminine, but 3,000 years ago was maybe different. I don't know. Like, to understand how evolved all this construction, no?
Yes.
How changed.
Now, I'm talking about underneath the social construction, is there something deeper than that?
You mean a sense of whether we're male or female?
Yes. And I mean, we're dealing with something here that you could say, well, maybe you're just dealing with levels of social construction, and the sort of deeper sense of being male and female that I'm alluding to is just something that was constructed, if you like, emerged out of the species, out of the animals, and was constructed in the human race and our forebears over maybe millions, if not hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of years, that there's some bedrock of male and female behaviour that the sort of social constructions we're looking at, if you look at that history, we're looking at the tiny bit of the surface, right, which is all negotiable and changeable. And my, I guess what I was trying, what I was alluding to in that last lecture, right, which I didn't say probably rightly, is that my sense is that in, on that surface where we're unsure of our gender and what's socially constructed, the sense in me is that we're losing touch with this deeper archetypal, almost Jungian sense of what a man and a woman is. Well, I would say it depends whether you've got in touch with the archetypal male or female. It depends on that's why I say I'm not qualified to say.
But doesn't you see, Jung say that we have both, everybody, every individual has both animus and animus?
Oh yes, and I've been having an I've been arguing with the Jungians about this. So let me put it this way. Am I deluded in my love of the eternal feminine? All right, just let me just put it down. Am I deluded in my love of the eternal feminine? Is the eternal feminine a fiction?
I think it doesn't matter. If you love it, but you don't impose it on other people. You know, if you prefer to have that ideal, but you're not expecting other people to
well, I don't know that what I'm talking about is a sense that there's a deep there's something so. I mean, you can't impose that on someone else.
It's not. Care about other people, then you won't. And I just don't think that it's relevant. If people care for each other, then it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter when you love a child. You're not loving them as expression of feminine or masculine, or that's all tied up just in their personality. And I don't think.
No, I don't mean as a child. I mean, in sexual love.
But still, the concept of feminine has changed a lot. Already in.
Yeah. No. But can I say again? I'm not talking about that layer of what of our concept of the feminine.
I think it's probably smell or something, isn't it?
I'm talking about something that I sense in myself is coming from the deep unconscious. And
I don't think you can lose touch in it, because like you say, you know, even if this is like waves on a very deep ocean, then the waves are the waves and the ocean is the ocean.
Yes.
It cannot.
You can't separate them, but you can go to it. Once you're in a greater depth, the surface doesn't look so important. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So there must be some sort of something in the depth that yet enables those variations on the surface. And so.
So
if having this depth is a comforting idea, because you mentioned something about women soldiers, yeah, and I grew up in Israel where women go to the army and become soldiers, and more they become kind of in more front type of more fighting kind of positions, whereas when I grew up they were still maybe a little bit behind or guys, but not like fighting, and now they're fighting, and it's like, I didn't like it. I kind of fancied that the more like princessy kind of woman, gentle, whatever, which is why I married an English woman who had nothing to do with the Israeli culture. But,
yes.
You know, but you know, maybe like you said, maybe having this, being able to release the aggression is actually making women more happy on the long term.
Yes.
And there's something quite constricting on the, so it's complicated.
Well, I'm suggesting, and I'm only suggesting this, that people more or less, in my experience, don't really know what I'm talking about here. Because, that's putting it, maybe that's putting it in a wrong way, but I'm talking about something I've discovered in my life through love that I didn't know about. I'm not talking about girls being pretty and wearing makeup, and that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something that is probably best expressed with the idea of Tantra from the East, that there's a possibility of a deep union between man and woman that isn't really isn't part of our normal understanding. And I'm not saying I'm in some special place either. I'm just saying that I've had glimpses that there's some deep potential between the male and the female principles in the psyche. That this is me concluding last week's lecture. That in some level the surface that we're living in now, in relation to gender, is obscuring the possibility of that for people.
What about gay people?
Well, I think that's just beyond my experience, but I think that it's not inconceivable, is it? That the male can come up in a female body, and the female can come up in a male body. It's not.
People might feel very male or very female.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Right? I don't know at what level. I'd like to be God, if you like, and look at the human psyche and say, oh gosh, that's what's going on. But all I really know is what's going on in my psyche.
I suppose I'm a bit wary of someone who's not me saying this is what a female is like, this is an archetypal female, which is imposing something on me, whereas I think, well, I say what I'm like. So
yes. No,
ideals can be sort of oppression or wrapped up.
That's what I mean
yeah.
In a way, you know, the whole even talking about it starts to produce
yes.
a kind of reaction
because it's difficult.
I'm aware of that, so usually I don't
convey what you
yes.
mean, which in a way that doesn't trigger other people, other
yes.
things, other experiences of being patronized or being in other people, which you're not trying to do, but
I mean, I would say something more. I would say that in that dynamic between man and woman, man has betrayed woman.
Mm. Yeah. Who's man though? It's all individual.
Yes. So I'm talking about the archetypal the man through history. Man who built the world, if you like. Well, do you think woman had a see how difficult it is? I regard the kind of world that we're now living in, that it emerged from, I'm not talking about yesterday, I'm talking over centuries. It came out of this, what we're talking about, this aggressive separating principle, which expressed itself, and we were going to be neutral, expressed itself more through man than through woman. I don't think unfortunately I just wanted to wrap up the lecture. Whereas, again, we're opening up this domain where...
But also that what you say about, maybe as men, I can talk about myself, there is some sort of sense of guilt, similar to some sort of guilt about colonialism, of the West, and other sort of guilt that we are aware that we had power and we abused this power, obviously, in different things, maybe more than other women abused their power, or the African abused their power. We abused our power maybe to a greater extent. That's one thing.
Can I just say one thing in relation to that?
Yeah.
I'm hard pushed to think of any culture on earth that has ever attempted to change its ways. Apart from our, any culture, I'm trying to think, culture that's historical culture that has actually tried to redress the imbalance between men and women, that has actually withdrew from colonialism, and actually I'd like you to kind of a little reflection back into, before we feel too bad about ourselves, a little reflection back into history about all the other cultures, all the other empires, all the other civilizations that we know about, and their behavior.
It's a bit simplistic to see cultures as being one thing, to talk about, you know, there's not been a culture that has tried to change its ways. I mean, cultures and societies are made up of many, many different opposing groups, and they fight, they combat each other among themselves.
Is that supposed to be a fire alarm?
No.
No.
And I think there have been, otherwise you'd never get any social change if there haven't been changes, pushes to change.
I'm just wondering, what was the culture you're thinking of that decided it wasn't a good idea to go to war?
Have there been any specific cultures? There have been Pacific
who were warlike and renounced it.
Well, there have been Pacific movements within different cultures, haven't there?
Which ones?
Well, even in Judaism, you know, basic Christianity, it's about the principle of.
No, I'm just I'm the Romans. No, I don't think. I'm thinking. You know, the Muhammad civilization, Islam. No, I'm thinking about these cultures in cultures in Africa that you think of. Warlike culture that renounced war. I'm glad to get specific.
The way those
we
Greek...
might not know, John.
I know we might not know, but I'm just wondering if anyone does know of any other culture where the utterly dominant culture that had that renounced war. You might say we haven't renounced war, of course, but the movement to renounce war in our civilization is. Do you know they were partying in 1914? Let's get stuck in. What war? That's health. To go to war, that's a sign of a strong, manly, vigorous culture. It's only your response to how guilty we feel about how bad we've been. You know, it needs to be balanced by a look back at.
Yeah, but even before you balance it out, we need to explore it a bit and say that, you know, we have been colonialists, we still are on economic level and on, you know, political level, we're colonializing parts of the world, mainly Africa, for example, and South America. So we do have a lot to answer for, and I think that kind of sense in us that you say men betray women is coming maybe out of that, because the state of the world is that you've got people like living in complete poverty in one side, and we all live like kings, and you know, some part of us, this is maybe relating to this, you know, love, is crying about this, because we know deep inside that it's not okay that there is a child in Africa who is starving. We know that.
Yes.
At some level we know that. So
yes.
So that's why we feel what we feel.
Yes.
But, you know, that is a side to the men and women question in general, in as much as, you know, you can have a very coherent and harmonious and equal society where women are a bit more, warriors or whatever. So it's kind of... I think that these are two separate kind of issues.
Which are the separate issues? Sorry.
One is the
betrayal of woman, by
man.
Are we clear what that? I don't think I said what I meant by that.
Okay.
So, let me throw another.
Are we going to do the lecture?
We are, but then it's just. I feel I just want to throw one more thing up. So with the betrayal of was a betrayal of love. Betrayal of love. It was a transforming of woman into a kind of a sexual object and a beast of burden. Mm. That was the betrayal.
Can I just say maybe you need a new interpretation? interpretation. It doesn't have to be that male-female interpretation anymore, and it can make way for a better, more a different interpretation or a different symbol, because right now maybe that can change.
Well, I guess I've got more old-fashioned as I got older.
That's not an excuse.
I don't mean it as an excuse. I mean my sense that as being more old-fashioned as I got older is that I'm finding that there's something of value in our past and our attempts to a lot of what we're doing now is an attempt to utterly forget the past and recreate ourselves out of nothing.
That's quite good, that people are revisiting the past and without all the sort of rhetoric and the rundown and seeing it's different from what people thought it was.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
In the way that people are manipulated to go to war. And,
yes.
You know, people have more access to information about the past, maybe.
But I guess my thinking of the past is related to what we're doing now in this class, which is the deep past, the past aware, that preceded our current kind of form of consciousness, what that grew out of, and even to. I guess part of the this course is to come to a kind of an understanding of what kind of consciousness it is that we're inhabiting now. Because our reflections on our past in our culture are reflections on a past that we understand within a certain frame of mind. And it's the frame of mind that I'm interested in, rather than what it... how it understands its past. Anyway, let me just... I just didn't think I read the last paragraph. Can I, before we start the next lecture? If we do not see that ethical concerns arise in love and we believe that they belong to the domain of our rationality, in our desire for a harmonious social life, we begin to use rational arguments or even force to secure something that looks like ethical behaviour. As we lose respect for our emotions, we begin to use rational arguments to hide, deny or justify them. We do so in a path that progressively leads to the negation of the other through manipulation as we become homo sapiens agressans. I don't know why I think that should be said with a vaguely French accent. In the expansion of the patriarchal passion for control. We know all this, but we forget it in the delusion of omnipotence through a misunderstanding of intelligence, as we think of it as an instrument of control and manipulation. So that was just that. I almost feel like now that I just, can we close the door on the male and the female issue, because this is really about love, and it's about what happens when we lose a sense of love for each other, and we think that being ethical is something that we can legislate for. And I take on board what Maria said last time, which is, but that legislation has actually changed things as well. And that is there if we just reflect back, those of us who lived, you know, over a series of decades, you can see that attitudes have changed. But those of us who lived over a series of decades, I think also, I don't know, this is just getting the sense that attitudes, something's getting worse again. I don't know if you feel that. Not just Trump, but that in a way there was an underlying sort of, things were getting better in a way that were, one was almost taking for granted.
Yes, I feel.
And there's a feeling that there's been a reversal. I mean, it probably started with Margaret Thatcher, but it was like the the change of direction started there, but the actual effect, you know, the psyche responds slowly. But I feel like the effect of Thatcherism is now really being felt.
Of Thatcherism.
Yeah. Yes. That undoing of the impulse that was there after the Second World War that formed the what was called the welfare state, and that's not really the right word. There was an impulse to restructure society and make it more just.
It's in those countries, because in other countries they're actually making progress in the opposite direction. New Zealand or Iceland or
Holland is another one too.
Yeah, it's staggering to kind of, you know, witness the two things happening. You almost like, how can it happen that they are becoming more socialist and going for the green transition and doing all of those things, and yet we are kind of like voting for the opposite.
Yes, it's a strange effect, isn't it? It seems to be, and the USA and the UK, you know, represent a certain. I mean, we're very different to the Americans.
Practice of evil.
Yeah, but you know, it's like something's happening to that part of the psyche at the moment. But we won't go into that either, right? We're going to start. With this more a secondary view of what Maturana and Verdenzola were talking about, because there were just I'd like in a way to see how a more conventional understanding of the development of language, it looks like it disagrees with Maturana and Verdenzola, but in a way they're complementary. But I think it would be good to see it from two perspectives. So, The Master and His Emissary, I just wonder, is anyone aware of this book before I suggested it as a reading? No. You see, in my world, this is like, surely you've all read that. It's one of those sort of books. It's not a science book, right? If in our culture, The Master and His Emissary. It's
Ian McGilchrist.
You've all heard about the left brain and the right brain. It sort of became part of popular culture, I think, in the 60s and 70s. You know, the left with the right brain controlling the left. It's all artistic and holistic, and the left brain that controls the right side is all logical and horrible. Do you know? There's a pejorative sense of the two sides of the brain, and also a bunch of labels like, you know, I keep getting it wrong. You know, the right brain, which controls the left side, is artistic, creative, intuitive, kind of. Nobody wants to say. If you're going to put a gender on it, you say it's more feminine, but we don't want to talk about gender. And if you put a gender on the other side, it tends to be, you know, we were looking at the agressons and the amants. You would tend to say that, oh yeah, the right brain is the loving side and the left brain's the aggressive side, maybe, but it's not as simple as that. But McGilchrist revisited that kind of pop culture notion that you can just stick attributes on one half of the brain and stick attributes on the other half of the brain, which in my world, that view became totally discredited because it was just incorrect and too simplistic. People at Sussex University, who are colleagues there, they never talk about the left or right brain. You know, I think in the background there's this attitude, oh, that was just part of pop culture, it wasn't based on any science, and we're dismissive. The brain is looked at in terms of its what the different areas might be specialised in, rather than thinking that there are two distinct hemispheres here. And McGilchrist's book revisited that and said, but it wasn't all rubbish, all of that left brain, right brain distinction. It's just more refined than that. You can't say that there are particular faculties like the left brain does mathematics. But you would say that if certain parts of the left brain are destroyed by a lesion or by a stroke, then your ability to do mathematics is severely compromised. And most understandings of what the brain's doing or what different parts of the brain's doing is informed by brain damage. And I sometimes mention this, you know, there's a whole bunch of kind of ghoulish scientists in the background should a part of your brain, an unusual part of your brain, be destroyed, they'll be at your bedside. They'll be, oh, great, we wondered what that bit of the brain was for. Do you mind if we, go do a few tests, you know, ask a few questions, a bit of scanning. Oh, that's marvellous. So your hippocampus is completely knocked out and nothing else. That's even great. You know, that's even better. As long as, especially a localized destruction like that. Scientists figuring out it's very quite brutal in a way. That and brain scans. And brain scans, you know, by and large, just say, well, there's a lot of blood going through there.
Okay.
Yeah.
But at least that's like an ethical framework, because obviously back sort of in the 19th century they used to actually damage people's brains.
Yeah, yeah.
They used to inflict harm.
Let's not think about that.
That's true.
Of course, you know,
Still doing a bit of that.
Yeah, let's not concern. Like, we'll be going back to Nazi Germany and all kinds of stuff like that, right? So where, you know, we'll put that back in the under the table. But the gist of it being that an awful lot of that simplistic brain science said, okay, we knock out Broca's area in the brain, you can't speak anymore. That must be where language is. But as studies have kind of continued over time, you know, and you amass more and more evidence, you find that, of course, it's a bit like the idea that one gene codes for something. One area of the brain is necessary for language, and if you take it out, it's like you've broken part of the circuit that produces language, but there's a much bigger circuit that involves both sides of the brain that produces language. So there's a more broader understanding of what different areas of the brain are for.
And also this maybe, you know, the brain plasticity.
Yes. Yes, in fact, that's the great synchronistic. Yes, there's a lot of evidence. I think we spoke of this before in the class, that if a certain area of the brain gets knocked out, then the function that it was performing can be taken over by another part of the brain. So the brain isn't... It's not that there are fixed modules in the brain that are dedicated to doing certain things by their very like hearts and livers and lungs. A particular area of the brain can be used for many different things, although it does so happen that when the brain forms, what a certain area of the brain does is determined by what sensory nerves project into that part of the brain and how that part of the brain is connected up to the motor system as well. So it's like areas of the brain, of course they are specialised, but they're specialised because in terms of how that part of the brain is connected to the rest of the body. That's what causes the specialisation. And I think we mentioned the ferrets before, didn't we? You know, they messed around with ferrets and, you know, reconnected sensory inputs to different parts of the brain, and although you can't interview a ferret and say what's it like, you know, hearing through your visual cortex, they say, oh, I hear a lot of colours, but you can't get that kind of information off a ferret, but you can tell by their behaviour that they can still hear and see.
Mm-hmm.
So you know that the functionality is still there. So the McGilchrist has sort of summarised a lot of more recent research to say that there is something going on. The brain is divided in half. There is a corpus callosum, that an area between the two hemispheres of the brain that connects them, and that they, each half of the brain can behave reasonably autonomously and in a disconnected fashion from the other half of the brain, as evidenced by the fact that certain people with epilepsy have had their corpus callosum severed. So it was actually an operation that cuts the brain in half, and people continue to function when they're not communicating with each other at all. Although, of course, they're both going to be connected to the spinal cord and the earlier parts of the brain. So they'll have some common connections, but their interconnections are severed. So it's quite puzzling. There seems to be a certain duplication going on. Of course, if one, and then there's the stroke victims, where a whole half of the brain is knocked out, and the other half's still functioning, where you can get another kind of idea about what the two halves of the brain are doing, and it turns out that you can still function with just using one half of the brain. So it's an ongoing area of research to try and figure out what sort of advantage, you know, in that evolutionary sense, could there be in the brain being divided like this. And McGilchrist's conclusion, and not, he hasn't just made this up, is that it's something like this, because it goes right through the mammalian and right into the birds as well, this separation of the brain into two halves. So it's not just a human thing. I guess it's somewhere he put it very simplistically. You're pecking around, you know, in the dirt looking for seeds, and one part of your attention is going to be very finely attuned to what's going on in the dirt and the seeds, and finding a particular morsel of food there. But if you're going to survive, you have to be scanning the bigger environment. And the gist of the findings that sort of summarizes McGilchrist's book is that it's the left brain that deals with the focused attention, and it's the right brain that deals with the broad awareness of context. So there are two forms of attention occurring at once, simultaneously. But generally, for consciousness, when you're attending in a focused way, your consciousness is in the focus. Now you can become, you know, almost in a disciplined way, you can become more peripherally conscious. But you always have to do a deliberate pulling back to do that. I do commend this book to you. It's not a science book. It's meant for popular culture, but in a good way. You know, there are popular culture books that are
trash,
and there are serious attempts to explain the science to not just to the general public, but what the book's trying to do is connect up people who are in different disciplines, and say to people who are in neuroscience, look, this is the effect that the brain has had on our culture. So he's trying to unify the picture of what the brain's doing in all the disciplines: sociology, history, psychology, neuroscience, and science itself, because he wants to draw a grand conclusion in this book. Which is something along these lines. So I have to give you this background really before we look at what he has to say about language, which is that our entire culture is a kind of imbalance where the left brain has become dominant in a way that is become less than optimal for our survival. His view of history, I think he would see the entire scientific revolution and the development of Western culture as a kind of and here we have to say a necessary development of the left brain, a necessary coming to the fore of potentialities in the left brain, that now in a way it's like he's more Jungian in this way, which is now become imbalanced. It's not that the left brain has to be destroyed. It's that it's risen to such ascendancy now that the right brain is unable to maintain the balance, which is its job, right? Its job is to see the bigger picture. So his conclusion is that the two brains are involved in different kinds of attention. So you can't say that an artist doesn't need focused attention. You can't say art is part of the lovely intuitive right brain, and then you can't say that mathematics is all the left brain affair, because mathematics involves intuitive insight, especially if you're searching for a proof. If you're a mathematician, you're working at the forefront of mathematics, then a kind of chugging assembly line type thinking that you get in the, let's get it the right way around, the left brain, is not what a mathematician would use to come up with a new theorem. But you need both, right? You need both. So you can't say that mathematics is on one side of the brain or the other. And similarly, you can't say that language is on one side of the brain or the other. Yes.
That's a really interesting idea. But it occurs to me that there's another problem as well, rather than just left brain ascendancy. I think if you look at, he's talking about modern culture, I'm guessing. Yeah. I think one of the things I've noticed in modern culture is that you also get a kind of a bigger split between the two. So people, or not so much people, but issues are either left brain issues or right brain. I mean, in the right brain stuff, you get this whole kind of culture of being stupid, which is kind of being presented and elevated. And, you know, there's no need for intelligence or reason. We can have reality TV and entertainment and completely devoid of this. And then you've got left brain stuff becoming more and more and more specialised and divided up and fragmented. So you've got, it's not just the fact that the left brain has become dominant, it's also that the two have become very split apart.
Yes. I mean, I feel I have to commend the book to everyone. I feel if I was in charge of, you know, national education, which I'm sure you agree I should be, you know, this would be required. If I got into a room and said, "Who hasn't read this?" I'd say, "Well, get out," you know, go back to school. Yes.
Well, just going on from what was said there by Marina. Yesterday, I was just looking at a YouTube video, and it was about culture and it was about language, but in Quebec, Canada. And it was very much kind of saying that the Quebec accent is frowned upon, a bit like Brazilian Portuguese might be, or American English compared to a British accent. And the idea was almost in terms of this, that Quebecers themselves, perhaps like Australians, I don't know, who might don't like the idea, to conquer new lands, they had to be can-do, hands-on, and not really worried too much about theorising about things, which could be about a left-right brain kind of thing. And that the modern-day culture, in terms of reality TV and stuff, it's almost, and there's this almost anti-intellectualism that has got kind of programmed into the culture itself, and that, so you get the French being very snobby towards the Quebecers as a result of this. So I'd be saying, well, we're the ones that have got all the culture, you haven't got any culture, and that there's a kind of resentment now. I know I'm going slightly off piece, but there is a tenuous link there somewhere.
So I guess the reason I'm saying read the book is because I'm not sure that I think, how can I don't think you're going to have a good picture of what the right brain is without looking at it very seriously. Even our picture of the right brain is a left brain picture. And being left brain doesn't mean necessarily being clever or intelligent or logical. The left brain can be sloppy and illogical, but still be left brainy in its form of attention. You see, for those of you who've done, a bit of phenomenology with me, which is pretty much everyone, more or less. No, it's not everyone, but looked into what phenomenology is about. Phenomenology, I would say, is about looking into the background, the background consciousness, intelligence that is forming our very experience. Now, I would associate the right brain with the background intelligence that is actually forming our experience every moment. So it's an extraordinarily intelligent intelligence. But it's, and I mean, if this course goes well, I think we should get to an understanding that of what McGilchrist means by this right brain intelligence. He means something that we hardly know of in our current state of consciousness.
Can you tell us what the title means?
So the master and his emissary. The master is the right brain. The emissary is the left brain. So essentially, it's part of that. It's part of an Eastern myth, which says, in effect, there's a deep intelligence within, if you like, capital S self, as it's sometimes called, you know, in Eastern traditions, and the left brain. Hi, Delphine. In this model, which is McGilchrist's model, is the emissary that the master has sent out into the world. So the emissary is supposed to be making the contact out here and doing stuff. Within the greater consciousness or the greater intelligence of the master, and the book in a nutshell is that I don't know if you know these stories from the East. The book in a nutshell is the emissary thinks that it's the boss. The emissary thinks it's in charge. The emissary, in a certain way, has forgotten the master, but hasn't really. It's a kind of, psychically speaking, the emissary is deliberately belittling and separating itself from the deeper intelligence on which it depends. That's. I don't want you to take that. You don't need to read the book now, but that's. that's a kind of a synopsis of the book. So it's got a very, it's got a quite a deep insight. That, you know, I feel like there are various things in my own intellectual development, you know, little pieces of the puzzle, where you see, ah, he's seen a piece of the puzzle, you know, and I think McGilchrist has seen a piece of the puzzle that, say, someone like Heidegger or Husserl, they couldn't see that, right, because the science wasn't in place. You know, because we shouldn't, it's, you know, you can... Something here was I was saying earlier on, the left brain produced science. Well, that's of course not true. There's a certain form that our science has taken that the left brain, if you like, has hijacked. But science itself has just found stuff out. It's and what it's found out about the brain. There is two sides to it. We've got an awful lot of things that we know about the brain that we didn't know before. But if you like, what's happened is that we've taken what we've understood about the brain, and cognitive science and neuroscience, by and large, have already got an understanding of the brain that it's a sort of a machine. So everything that you find out about the brain is then cast within that model that the brain is a machine, you know, made by DNA and evolution and nature and all the rest of it, but it's still just a framework within which what we've discovered about the brain has been understood. You can still take what you've discovered about the brain and understand it within another framework, and in a way that's what McGilchrist is attempting to do. He's actually, I think, in his way, attempting to understand the brain with an understanding that is phenomenological, even though he's not a phenomenologist. His phenomenological understanding is that whatever you look at, you in the background, you've got a certain pre-understanding of what you're looking at. And that pre-understanding of what you're looking at totally determines what you see. So what should be of deep interest to us all is to look into the background, which is determining how we see. You know, that if you want to understand, my understanding of phenomenology is that's phenomenology.
But then it's creating a hierarchical situation in the brain where you kind of say, well, this side is actually the one which has the broader view, that has the vision, that has the understanding. And the other side is just some kind of emissary that's gone out of control, think he's the boss now and does whatever he wants, and lacks the intelligence of the other.
Yes, exactly. Just what I'm saying, right? That's a form of projection, right? And then,
yeah, but then when you say that, you can see why the emissary wouldn't like it and would like to rebel and would like to take over, because nobody wants to be told, well, you're just an emissary, I'm the one who's got the intelligence. You're going to do what I say. Well, you now got out of control and you started to do what you like, which is why society looks so crap, which I agree to a certain extent. You know, the fact that our cities and culture look like they look is a failure of, you know, we, with our capacity, we could have created something a lot better than what we've created. Just regressing, like even on the point of architecture, you know, when you think about how in the past architecture was a lot nicer than it is today and makes you feel more at home and cozy than it is today. So obviously something has gone out of control, this mystery has gone out of control, but I think it's maybe because if you view them as master and a mystery, then by viewing it like this, you're already creating the tension that will lead to the conflict. And so we'll be better off trying to think of another understanding that will enable them to really be equal.
So
this is how it's meant to be.
So once again, there's an issue here. It's almost like the issue of gender. It's like, well, I don't want to be rude, but are we in a shop? Ah, yeah, it's the worldview shop. I think, I like that. I think I'll take that worldview. You know, that accords with something in me. You know, I like that worldview. I don't think that this worldview that I thought I liked is causing me problems. I think I'll buy another worldview. I guess the question do we have any ground within us whereby we could see whether there's any truth in that?
I'm happy to examine.
What would be absolutely crucial for all of us as human beings would be to discover whether we have such a capacity in us to see into the truth of anything, rather than being in this shopping mall of, you know, pick your attitude. Yes.
Oh, I was just curious. Which side, which hemisphere do they think dreams come from?
Don't know. I'd go to D, and I think he may have said something, but I'm, yeah, Nicola, look it up. I don't know how you, I mean, having read the book,
a few years ago, I
would be surprised he hasn't mentioned dreams, but I can't remember what he
said. On occasions, one can get dreams that provide a bigger picture.
Yes.
When one's being too bogged down with something, like in my experience.
Yes.
Suddenly you have a dream, yes. And then you wake up and think, oh my God, I completely not seen
But I guess we're in an area here where I'd like to say something like something Jungian in a way. You know, I know Jung's picture of the psyche is.
So he said there's something here.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to read it all out because it's a bit long, but it says all this is perhaps in keeping with evidence suggesting that during REM sleep and dreaming. There is greatly increased blood flow in the right hemisphere, particularly the temporoparietal region. The EEG coherence data also point to the predominance of the right hemisphere in dreaming.
Right.
So thank you, Nicola.
There is a bit, page 188 will tell you a bit more than that, because he starts off with Freud and preconscious and unconscious.
No, it just struck me.
And then it goes on a bit further.
I thought that might.
So I just got giving you another view off the shelf in the shopping mall of world understandings. Jung's view, as far as I can grasp it, is that in some way there's a, and this comes from other people as well that I've come in contact with. It's like the psyche is has a material layer. And this is the material layer of the psyche, and it starts to shade off and become less and less material, and there's a certain point where it becomes immaterial. There's a continuum there, and so the psyche has is a repository of things that have happened, of behaviours, of the experience of the human race. That can project itself down into the brain and change the way that the brain functions. That there's a continuum of material to immaterial, and that certain dreams, I'm coming from Jung here, certain dreams will be communications from the psyche that then can form the brain to something that's in the psyche. So you wouldn't be able to say that was a right brain or left brain thing, although science would say it's a right brain thing, because it's probably the right brain that can conform itself to the psyche, if you see what I mean. But that's just the story. Again, you know, there's a certain amount of empirical evidence for the to indicate that. And it's all in parapsychology, to indicate that we certainly can't explain everything that's going on in the brain in terms of physical cause and effect. But that's just not part of our worldview, if you know what I mean, because for good reason. I mean, I've either. This is a big digression, but there's a good reason why science says, well, okay, but we're only going to actually deal with things that you can demonstrate here, because if we open the door to parapsychology, it's science itself, empirical science, will collapse. You know, there's a reason why there's a boundary around it. Is there a science that can accommodate a bigger picture? Well, that's partly, you know, there are a lot of people working on that at the moment. But it tends to be a bit like the way medieval science didn't even think of itself as science. The medieval worldview was, it didn't just kind of slowly change into a modern scientific worldview. It collapsed and was replaced. And it may be that our current worldview is going to have to go through a similar collapse rather than a gentle transition. You know, if it was going to go through a gentle transition, it should have started around about 1910. You know, we're about 100 years late. We're about 100 years behind what our science has actually discovered. You know, we're still thinking like Victorians, really. So that's just a bit of a introduction to the book. There's a lot more in the book. We're just going to drill into the chapter that he had to, that he you know, we wanted to speak about language. But the kind of core message is that it's to do with different forms of attention. But if we're looking at how this relates to what Maturana and Bird and Solow are saying, it's the right hemisphere that's concerned with the broader context of the emotional contact that we have with everyone else around us. That's regarded as a right brain. The right brain is concerned with the well-being and how everyone's feeling about each other. I mean, in a way, you have to take a book like this and then try and read it into your experience as best you can. I don't know if you know this yourselves, but I recognise in me something that has a very good idea about what's going on in everybody else, even though I'm not necessarily aware of it. Often I become aware of it later, when something goes wrong. You know, when something goes wrong in a relationship, and you realise you're in a kind of a dream, and when the thing goes wrong, you realise you knew what was going on all the time, but you chose not to see it. Do you know that? We get these two levels. Or even in an organisation, you know something bad's going on, but you choose not to see it. You know,
but is that not just that you become more objective towards it because you have space from it?
Possibly.
So rather than being involved with it, you are, you know, you're looking at what went on with hindsight.
Yes, but I guess I'm talking about there was something that knew all along. I've had this at several points in my life the extreme example is Nazi Germany, where a whole bunch of people at the end of the war said, well, we didn't know about the gas chambers and all the rest of it, you know, and there were millions of people in Germany, right? Don't mean to single you out, but that's a kind of it's a great example where I think everybody knew what was going on.
To some
level. Yeah, yes.
You choose to pick it out.
Yeah, yeah, because it's too awful. Yeah. It's too awful. And what are you going to do?
And I guess we're doing that with you know, what's going on, with the way that we treat the animals that we
yes,
eat. You know,
absolutely.
We all know that that something absolutely horrendous goes on every minute of every day behind closed doors, and we just, you know, shut it out. But I think, yeah, and I guess because if we did open our heart to it, we would have to do something about it.
Yes. So, I mean, and in relation to that, I don't want to get...
You had that about the street people in Brighton.
Yeah.
Not so long ago.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, not the uncovered street people, but
yes.
People,
yeah. People living
on the
streets in Brighton. There's an example, isn't it?
You thought if you lived in Brighton, you'd have to do something.
Yeah, yeah. Because I guess I put a ring around... You know, there's a thing from the Bible, isn't it? You know, God give me the strength to change what I can change. And to leave what I can't change, and the wisdom to know the difference, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, in a way, you can become super concerned about what's happening in Syria as you're stepping over the homeless person.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, there's something about, and again, this is to do with the right brain intelligence. It knows what matters to you. As well, and there's a kind of we're talking about something that you have to read very finely in your experience, because it's different for every one of us, what it is in a way that you're not seeing, or maybe you are, maybe you've become more attuned to what's going on there, because you know a lot of like Jungian analysis. You could say one. What's all this looking into your dreams about? Well, it's an attempt to say, well, you're not listening to a certain intelligence in you. So maybe one way to bring it to the fore is to look into what your dreams are saying.
So you're saying the right brain is.
But I don't want. If you see the danger here is you suddenly make the right brain everything. Whereas in a way, I'd like to say, well, there's a bigger psyche there. And I feel more like the right brain is a kind of a more attuned.
But can I just quickly check, is it the left brain that's sort of more, the left side that has to do more with sort of mathematical, is the right the creative part?
Well, so the general thinking now is that losing either side will impair your creativity. And losing either side will impair your ability to do mathematics. The work is distributed.
Okay.
Yes?
But is it not
but
they
you would
say that one is more for the sort of abstract and the other one is more for the sort of
yeah.
logical?
Yes. The left brain tends to be the analytic, take things apart, and the right brain tends to be the synthetic, put things together side, if you like. But you need both kinds of attention to be creative, and you need both kinds of attention to do mathematics. You need both kinds of attention to teach this class. Do you know there are two aspects of that in a way, you know, there's no reason why they can't blend together. As I was saying at the beginning, the gist of the book is saying, but what's happened is that there's been a schism, and that the attention on the parts and the bits. I mean, my experience of this at work was very strong at the university, where, and you might see this in the world at large, whenever something goes wrong, or isn't going the way you want it to go, or there's been an accident. What happens is the left brain, if you like, comes in with policies and procedures. We need to get a set of rules now. We need to identify what happened. We need to find out what the causes were, and we need to find some actions that will rectify it. And we need to write it all down. And we need everybody to adhere to our new policy and procedure that's going to fix the terrible thing that just happened. It's there when you hire somebody. We don't want you hiring somebody because you like them. We don't want you hiring somebody because you have a good feeling about them. We don't want you hiring somebody because they appear to have a little twinkle in their eye. of what you might think of as intelligence. You can't rely on that kind of stuff. We've got a series of check boxes here, and we're going to score each one. And at the end of the day, I mean, I've sat on these committees. You know, at the end of the day, when you've done all the check boxes, you're going to hire the wrong person. You know, what are they for? They're to make sure you hire the wrong person. You're going to hire the person that is going to be utterly negative and destructive, and you know, break down the kind of. You've just managed to find a bit of harmony together in your working life, and the check boxes and the policies and the procedures are going to force you now to work to hire somebody who's obviously not going to fit in. You know, it's like they've got an orange light on them, but in the check boxes there's no place for the orange light. You know,
who's playing devil's advocate? I could say you need more check boxes.
Yeah, exactly. As a computer programmer, you're going to say there's nothing wrong there. Is that we didn't have the rule to cover that?
Yeah.
You know, our policies and procedures weren't fine enough, and that's exactly what we do, right? They're not fine enough. We need more.
Yeah.
But let me say. I deeply sense, you see, that we have an extraordinary intelligence and ability to read other people, that we are legislating out of our lives.
Well, I think it starts with parenting. So we are, as children, you know, the mum or dad goes, stop, don't, and careful. And, you know, so we as children, we're not really able to develop our awareness and instinct about what is, you know, what is actually going on. And there's a book from the 60s where it describes how the Native Americans bring up their children, and it's okay for the child to go close to the fire and will experience its warmth and it will make sense of it, and it's very unlikely to run into the fire if you allow it to develop that awareness. And so I think that we're really early just taught to completely ignore it, because we have parents that go, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, and we don't have that space to develop it.
Yeah, I just like to say, I just, yes. Yes, Marie.
I was just thinking how when I taught self-defense, I would actually have to say to women, listen to how you're feeling, because they've done some research where they asked women who'd been attacked, did you know that there was something wrong before the person attacked you? And they all said yes.
Mm.
Why did you not do anything about it, like get away? And they all said, I thought I was being stupid.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so I used to get people very, very tuned in, for instance, to people breaking into their personal space, which is often a signal, and picking up other signals about what made them feel uncomfortable, and then listening to it. You know, like a lot of people know they're being followed in the street, but they don't do anything about it.
Yeah.
You know, the thing to do is to cross over, and if a person crosses over again as well, then you are being followed. Well, turn around and tell the person to go away. That often works, especially if there's other people around. So, but time and time again, this, what you're talking about, John, about this kind of, this we know what's going on at some deep level.
Yeah, yeah.
We know there's something wrong, but we don't listen to it.
Yeah.
We choose not to, we choose to say to ourselves, oh, I'm just imagining things.
We've taken a huge kind of a detour again, but the point of it really was to say, what, get some sense of what we mean, what McGilchrist means by the right brain, and it's very
fat.
It's subtle, and it's intelligent. It's already intelligent, because we I don't know if you remember any of the times that we've been looking at Heidegger and Husserl, where we start to go back into what we would consider to be the intelligence that's constituting the world, because I think it goes back that far. It's something that when our foreground consciousness sometimes in life actually gets to recognise it, and then it has a, it has what we might call a shock, that there's something more intelligent than it around. But you, that again, because we were talking about it, that's not a model. It's in a way, it's a moment of realisation. You know, that there's more going on here.
But it's fear, isn't it, that stops. Fear will stop you doing, turning around, saying bugger off, you know, or fear will stop you addressing the thing that in the team feels wrong.
Yes.
You know,
embarrassment as well.
Yes.
And you don't want to be seen as a, you know, like not coping or something.
But there's—I mean, we're in an area here where there's a lot. There's a lot going on. It's not as simplistic as that, is it? Because
no.
You generally you don't want to tackle someone because they are likely to be violent as well.
Yeah.
And you're about to.
In a,
yeah.
So you can pick that stuff up as well. Mm. I mean, I was followed one night about 3 o'clock in the morning in London by an extremely large guy. And every time I turned round to shout bugger off, he ducked into a doorway or bobbed down behind a car and continued to follow me. And in the end, I thought, right, I'm going to have to get rid of this guy. I don't want him to see where I live. So I started walking towards him, shouting, you know, what's the matter with you? Are you some kind of idiot? Bugger off. And he started to laugh. And at that moment, I knew that he was absolutely no danger to me whatsoever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because although laughing is a bit creepy at this point, it's actually a sign of nervousness.
Yeah.
So I continued to walk towards him, muttering threats, and he ran away. Even though he was, you know, three times my size.
Yes,
wow.
You're braver than me, Maria. Well, that
was
I
know
yeah,
what I'm saying, I'm
yeah,
not brave
yeah,
because I knew that
yeah,
he would be no threat.
You say that because of the warrior gene, isn't it, Nicolette?
I
yes,
know,
yes.
I knew, I knew. I wouldn't have done that if I thought he was dangerous.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Very often, very quiet people are dangerous. People who've gone quite pale in the face are dangerous. You can pick, yeah. If they're red in the face, you're fine. But if they go white, keep away. They're about to explode.
So I do all right, don't feel.
I think I found going between your imagination and your instinct, maybe in a less dangerous atmosphere where maybe you get a funny feeling in your house or in someone's house, and then is it your imagination or is that a true feeling?
Yeah.
And then how to tell the difference between instinct and imagination.
Because sometimes you do find things out, and actually, it was your imagination.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's
I think my imagination is stronger than
yes. No, there's all.
Really facing the facts.
There's all kinds of stuff. You know, it's like we're gonna have. It's like going into psychotherapy because you get a strong feeling about somebody because they remind you of your parents or a situation in the past, and it's actually quite a wrong projection that you're projecting on. You've got to be able to read the difference. Between this inner reading that is quite impersonal in a way, and an emotional feeling that you're projecting onto someone, you know, it's tricky stuff. It's not just a gut feeling, you know.
Just a worry. If you get into the habit of worrying about things, then you think that, then you'll convince yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
That you're
yeah,
feeling something.
Yeah, yeah.
I know.
You've got to identify who's in there. You know, you've got to identify which one's doing the talking here. Anyway, but that's so the left and the right hemispheres are a big tour, right? Because I just want to give you McGilchrist's view is quite different to what we were looking at with Maturana and Verdun Zola. To the extent where you might say that they contradict each other, and you know, what's going on here. So remember Maturana and Verdun Zola were saying that this process of evolution of languaging started maybe 3 million years ago and changed our bodies and came out of the extension of sexuality and our enjoyment of being together. You're not getting that story from McGilchrist. He's saying, I mean, it sounds a long time ago, 300 to 400,000 years ago, we're getting our first common ancestor that's looking like a modern human. Not quite Homo sapiens, but would be regarded as a potential ancestor of ours, because the brain was now large enough, the vocal apparatus was in place, we're starting to get something that looks like it could possibly have language like we do, although it doesn't appear that was so, for reasons that are on the slide. Maturana and Verdenzola were interested in, well, how did we get to, Heidelbergensis? That's a stab at saying it. How did we get there, right? How did we get from the higher apes to there? Because we're already starting to develop a modern body. What were the evolutionary forces at work that formed that body? So they're saying languaging was already occurring. But McGilchrist is saying, but language, as we understand it, is something else. So he's using the word language in a different... he means something different by it. I mean, if you do philosophy, which of course you are doing, everyone you read, the key words, you know, consciousness, language, truth, being, you have to work out what the person you're reading means by those terms. You can't look it up in a dictionary. All of the key philosophical terms that you come across, each philosopher will have their own meaning for those terms, because we're not talking about table, chair, computer. And it's no use saying, oh, well, you disagree. You have to first work out, well, no, you have to see, what do you mean by that term? If you just disagree about what the term covers, you may still be in agreement about the underlying situation that you're using your language to convey. And I think in a way we've got two different ideas of what language is here. For Maturana and Verdenzola, it was a way of behaving. Who can remember the consensual coordinations of behaviour? Yes, it was using vocalisation to coordinate behaviour. Whereas for McGilchrist, it's using words to refer to things. And that's what we tend to think of language to be, right? Whereas we were thinking of it earlier, it was as a form of coordinating behaviour. You don't necessarily need distinct words that refer to other things to use vocalizations to coordinate behavior. So you've got to kind of read the difference here. So he's saying that the evidence for what we consider language to be in our kind of culture, which we think of as having a kind of a fixed symbolic system that we use, clearly was there about 40,000 years ago. Clearly meaning people take great store by the cave paintings as evidence that something like linguistic consciousness is there, because we are able to make one thing represent another. So like a painting on a cave wall is representing an animal. That's taken to mean, well, so that's a kind of a parallel thing, is to make a sound represent an animal. If you can make a pic, something, putting some colour on a wall, and that representing an animal means that we've reached a point where, so we've got a particular ooh or new. It's a new, you know, do you see the parallel thinking? It's saying we would expect these visual representations to come with language. There's definite evidence that such cave paintings were there 40,000 years ago. In Aboriginal culture in Australia, there's indications that it was earlier than that, but there are difficulties with carbon dating. So there were some particular pictures of an extinct giant emu-like creature that was known to have gone extinct maybe 60,000 years ago. So the fact that there were aboriginal images of that animal indicate that things may go back further, it's hard to say.
And also there is a thing about things that remain and things that don't remain, so the ability to express things with sound didn't leave any traces, and
yes.
That may have predated that by, we don't know exactly
yes.
how much, but then, you know, if you say cave paintings are the beginning of language, you kind of rule out that maybe speech and sounds have predated it by a long, long way, but just didn't leave any trace.
Yes.
And also there are buildings that are older than the, what is it, how long are we supposed to be on this planet? I guess Homo sapiens, yeah? How long? 3,000 years?
No, we as a species, we're about 100,000 years old.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So,
but for our kind of our culture, in terms of cave paintings, not just that, but ceremonial burials are starting to leave traces, you know, of behind. Is 40,000 years to about 80,000 years, somewhere in that region.
Okay. All right. Yeah. But then scrub my idea.
So we're looking back into the sort of standard histories now, rather than the Maturana, which is quite a. He's thinking in evolutionary terms, that there was a lot of preparation before this kind of burst of human culture should emerge on the scene. And McGilchrist is portraying that part of ancient history, and this is only really back to say 300,000 or 400,000 years ago, as our hunter-gatherer preceding existence, where we didn't have language. I've highlighted it as we understand it, the sense being that people, humans, and our human ancestors were communicating together in some way or other. And then he's introducing this idea of Musi language, that there was a sort of a precursor to our syntactically structured language. Musi language is actually a term developed by a researcher who he refers to in the book. So there are papers that have been published on this. One of the findings, one of the ideas behind it is looking at the hypoglossal nerve, which is the nerve that controls the tongue, and looking back some 400,000 years ago, that nerve in our ancestors had already developed to the size it is today. So, and this is feeding back to Maturana, so what caused that? You know, what evolutionary benefit was there in because the nerve that controls the tongue controls our ability to make fine articulations of sound. Of course, the larynx and the development of the jaw, but the measuring of that, I don't know if you can see.
Just for anatomical reasons. That's not the hole, that's where the spine comes up. It's just in there where it's quite a small hole. That's what they were measuring, and they're looking at the that's enlarged considerably from all of our other, you know, living higher apes and the chimps. They don't have that kind of size of nerve, and of course we've got our lovely tongues, haven't we, and all the things we can do with them, but they're you take the tongue away, and it's very hard to, you know, it has a lot to do with how we shape the forms of the sounds that we that we articulate. So his proposition here, which is not his particularly, but it's part of a strand of research, is that, putting it simply, we were singing to each other.
There was something on the World Service the other day, going to Canary Islands, and where, because the mountains were so steep, there was an old language, well, not so much a whistling language, so that how people could convey over up to 8 miles, they'd whistle.
Yes.
So.
Yes,
and
McGilchrist mentions that I think there are existing cultures that still are doing that, are able to sing and whistle and communicate if they wish to. There are still existing forms of doing that. And he also mentions communications through drumming over a distance as well, that such languages have developed. And of course, we've got gesture, haven't we? So let me stick with the slide, though. So the explanation of this sophisticated control and modulation of the production of sound in the absence of language as we know it, he keeps qualifying as we know it, has to be that it was for nonverbal language in which there was intonation and phrasing but no actual words, i.e. music. There are significant similarities between music and language, which I think we are aware of, but we'll just spell it out, that suggest a common origin. They're built out of intonational phrases related by a kind of syntax, although musical syntax has more to do with the overall shape of the piece, you know, especially when you're singing, you know, the structure of language is very staccato, spoken language. There's all little pieces, and they're all put together, and they mean they're quite discrete, sharp assemblies that go to make a sentence. Whereas a musical phrase, the meaning of the phrase tends to be in the whole phrase there's a longer time span in to grasp the meaning of a piece of music. The individual tones only obtain their meaning from the phrase. They're not necessarily meaningful in themselves. It's how they are in combination. A sentence is the same, but the elements of a sentence are far more heterogeneous than the tones in music. But of course, you can be a tone. It can be sharp, loud, soft. You know, the way that it's formed, there's a tremendous variation in it. And of course, thinking of how songs are even now, you know, you have your verse and then your chorus and then the whole thing repeats, you know, and then we might introduce another theme. The structure of music is much more, has this kind of longer term repetition in it that we don't tend to get with our spoken language. You know, if you think of the stream of language that we've had been going on here, it isn't actually repeating too much. But if we were singing, we would probably come back, and we'd come back and start singing one of our favourite things all over again, wouldn't we? Do you know how it is? We might come back to something that, a motif that we were singing earlier, and if we were really, you know, singing, we might even start playing around with it. Do you know, changing it a little bit. But returning to it. Do you know there's a whole different structure to the way that...
Yeah, but there is some music that replicates that stream of consciousness sort of thing, that just like language, where it's not structured in any way.
Yes.
Where it's more, mimicking, I guess.
Yes.
And it's not trying to go back to any sort of structure or flow. It just goes and goes and goes.
Yes. And the question being, I guess, whether that kind of music has developed as a result of our language, or whether it would have preceded it.
I think it's a breakdown of musical structure, because I guess for, like, I don't know if you look at musical history, from a 17th century, everything was so rigid and structured, and then you get in like the 50s, the whole breakdown of the musical structure into something a little bit more language.
Yes.
I guess you had modernism.
Yes. Yes, I'm only questioning whether a lot of what's happened in music recently is an interaction between music and language. Of course it's impossible. I think it's impossible. He's going to say it's not impossible for us to reconstruct this, because we kind of recapitulated as children when we first learned language. In baby talk, the sort of sounds that we make is, but what our ancestors were singing, of course, remains. I don't know if it's completely close to us, but it's.
I always have a sense that we did sing. I don't know where I get that from, but I have the sense, deep sense, in me that we did sing to each other across sort of. We just sung to each other.
Yes.
And we were in a different place altogether, a different place of consciousness. We were just in a totally different place, but we were humans, but we were.
Maybe that's
just
why music touches us so much.
Yeah. That we used to.
That's like a memory.
Express in song to each other. But I can't tell you how exactly, but I sense it. I do sense that.
I don't know.
It's a long time ago.
Only
we communicated that way, that we. There was some melody, maybe a bit like the whistling, but it was a bit more expressive.
Has anyone read Schopenhauer
on
this? No, Arthur Schopenhauer, the German philosopher. His great kind of magnum opus was The World as Will and Representation, and he thought in his system he thought that the will that is. The being in itself of the universe. It's what lies behind what we think of as our experience. What lies behind it is a kind of a inconceivable unity of this will. But he thought that the only way you could get a possible idea of what the will is in music. So he had a lot to say. If you're a musician, it's worth reading Schopenhauer on music. But he was really, he thought music was the closest expression that we could have to what our being is. It's the way that we can express being. It's a fundamental expression of what it is to be. That we developed before we learnt to speak. That's what we're saying here. So, it was an expression. You know, you'd sing how you're feeling. You'd sing your impulse towards someone else. The essential thing that I mean, I'm getting ahead in the slides, is that our first communication wasn't about talking about what's over the mountain. It was our expression of our being together. It was to do with our social interaction, and of course for Maturana that would be our love. It would be an expression of our loving harmony, and of course there you have it. You know, that's what singing is. It's not just I'm singing to you. You know, I won't start it now, but you know how powerful it is if we all start to sing.
There is a movement now that people are singing together. People going to choirs, and you don't have to know how to sing, but you go to a community choir, and dotted all over the place now, people are coming.
The
sort of that feeling together that singing.
Oh yes, oh.
It's somehow
yes.
I feel blended, and it sounds really nice.
Yeah. Yes.
So it's a lovely thing.
It's
yes.
Swizzle, because you think you've been. That music is something that you consume and that only professionals can make, and people go, I can't sing, and everybody should sing.
Yeah, what?
Do you think that it was sort of instinctive? So there are sounds, I guess, that that express this, you know, unhappiness, and then there are sounds that are sort of that we would recognize as happy or positive sounds that we make.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if we knew that instinctively, or if that, you know, if that is something that we know now, or did we then made, you know, I don't know. It feels so natural that certain sounds are, you know, grumpy sounds or happy sounds, and so did they then have the same, and then perhaps shape the unhappy sound into a little bit more to sort of go.
Yeah, and the gestures, of course, and automatically come as well with singing, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And dancing, you know, there's the body's involved. It's not just the sound. It's how the body's expressing the sound as well. You almost can't, you know. Even I remember as a teenager, I had to play the guitar, the air guitar. You know, you just kind of want to emerge. You know, your body wants to be in there as well. In relation to that, I mean, I'm with Maturana on this. I think that we started to develop and extend our ability to communicate together in these close family groups, and probably each family group would start to develop its own way of singing, and particularly with the mother and the child. And then that would just... What you need then is for it to be reproduced, you know, reproduced through the generations. And then, you know, and that's, if you look at how languages are and how different they are in different cultures, you can see that it expands out of these little nuclei and spreads and forms a boundary. And the boundary's quite... I mean, people find it terribly significant, don't they? That's how the invaders understand... That's how the Romans, you know... Get them to speak Latin or whatever the Romans really spoke. Then we've got them. Get the children speaking the conqueror's language. It's all over. As the Welsh.
Yeah.
Yes.
But there's more people speaking Welsh now than there ever has been.
Yes.
But
did they lose? But have the Welsh lost the Welsh world in the intervening period? I don't know. Do you know if there's a difference between an English person learning Welsh and a Welsh person rediscovering that original world, you know, I mean, I suspect it's still there, you know, these things get recorded,
the
don't they?
It is, don't they, the Welsh people that speak, it's all to do with their culture, very much so, isn't it, strongly to do with culture. That's the impression I get.
The Cajuns are an interesting example in terms of language and music. For instance, so the Acadians, who formed part of New France, but got shifted off the land by the Brits, effectively, and then got scattered to the four winds. Some came back to France, but a lot then got settled in Louisiana, not necessarily New Orleans, but, you know, on the land, pushed away, and they're ordinary folk. But how they're passed on their culture is through the music.
Mm-hmm.
To the point that now it's become fashionable. So Americans, you might want to know about their roots, or, you know, there's an attraction there to kind of distinguish themselves from the lumpen mass. And you'll have Cajuns that can sing in French, but that's about it. And the French there is approximate, and it's... But they won't know anything else. But it's the music that's driven it. It's that coming together, a bit like with the group, as if to type of say, this is important, we want to hold on to this. And that's how they communicate.
Yeah.
A bit in certain, I think food plays an important part in cultures too, doesn't it?
Yeah, food definitely.
I mean, you're reminding me, you know, I was just about awake when the Beatles emerged. Just about, you know. 63, I was 3 years old, you know, but certainly when she loves you, yeah, you know, I was, it was all on the radio, and I wonder, because rock music emerged
out of you know, Frank Sinatra and Perry Como and the crooners, and it emerged as this entirely transformative. The music utterly changed the culture. I mean, there was other things, the pill, you know, the drugs, and da 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 da, right? But essentially, the music, for me too, it expressed something that you just couldn't put into words. You couldn't put into words. It said, "We ain't gonna live like you lot anymore," right? The music said that. It just said it's all over. You know, the flouncy dresses, all the makeup, and the "I'm going to work, dear." You know, it said it's all over. It's all finished. But no, it didn't. You didn't have to say it in words, right? Just the music said it. Just and I guess I'm old enough now I was there. I knew that other culture. I saw what the music did. Whereas it hasn't really, you know, it's ever since then, rock music has now become the new establishment, hasn't it? I mean, you go to university and study rock music. It can't do that like it did at that time. It can't herald a whole new way of being. You know, I don't know, the Beatles were like a kind of something extraordinary. Just extraordinary. I didn't know it until he was shot, but I became identified with John Lennon. You know, all through the music, these things go really, they go straight through the language. But the capitalism's recovered. It's a very resilient structure.
Well, it's part of the least resistance on some level, isn't it? It's easy to come.
You know,
it requires less effort to fall into capitalism than to rebel or to...
Yes,
or
yeah.
To become...
Yeah, no. The music when I was a teenager, maybe it's the same now, but it just said to me, there's another way to live here. You know, even though when you get to know the rock musicians, they weren't actually such great people. off stage, but the music said, do you know what? Anyway, we digress. We do digress, and. Do you want to turn? Shall I turn one of the fires off?
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting quite warm.
Yeah. Well, if we turn them both off, we'll be going, oh, it's cold.
But maybe we've got enough body heat, you know, now.
Yeah.
We're probably putting up a couple of kilowatts.
It's 10 minutes short. Right?
Yeah, I know. We didn't start till. So this slide is just saying. What's often seen in biology and ideas of evolution is that the sort of history of a species is recapitulated in the development of the children. Some more evidence for this is based in the way that children learn to talk. And having not had any children myself, I didn't observe all of this, so I'm taking McGilchrist's word for this. Although I do see, it's almost already in me to make stupid noises at babies. You know, it just kind of comes naturally, doesn't it? You know the baby can't talk, so what do? You start making sounds, don't you? It seems to be within us.
It's a mother res. It's mother ease or something like that. I think that's what it is when the mob sings at the beginning.
I mean,
I'm singing as well, even if I do remember singing "You Are My Sunshine."
Yes.
Even in
turn
without realizing I was doing it.
Yes.
I used to hate people talking to me like that when I was a child.
That's when you were a child.
Yeah, no.
Even when I was tiny. I mean, the people say.
Even when you were 5 months old, Maria, weren't you? You were going.
But you do have a pattern, like a singing pattern. And yeah. It's when people do it inappropriately, when you're of an age.
I suppose when I was about four, I started to become aware that people talk to you like you were an idiot because you were four.
No, yeah.
No, I wouldn't do that. No. I wouldn't do that. I tend to talk to children, and I assume that they can follow Heidegger.
You know, that's. It's as well. My son was five when he told me all humans are vermins.
Amazing.
So he was never appreciated.
So newborns, I'll read this just so we can confirm for those of you who had children. Are already sensitive to rhythms of language. They prefer infant-directed speech, otherwise known as baby talk, which emphasises what is called... Well, how do you pronounce that?
Prosody.
That'll do. The music of speech. In response to this, mothers expand the pitch excursions, go higher and lower, broaden the repertoire and raise the overall pitch of their speech, as well as slowing the tempo and emphasising its rhythm. As soon as their child is born, so we're saying there's almost an instinctual guiding of the way the sounds are, guiding it towards the way we sing our language, which different languages are different in that respect, aren't they? English isn't very sing-songy, is it?
I don't know.
I speak it, but if I hear say French. Oh, bonjour, you know, how are you? It's not that I speak French, but there's a lot more pitch excursions, if you like.
A lot of music is conducted in English, not only because it's the international language, but I think it lends itself perhaps in the construction.
I don't know. I don't think so.
Italian.
Yeah, Italian.
I think there's also a use of rhyming. As well, that comes into play at some point in the development that helps to, you know, introduce new words or kind of hint towards a certain word by rhyming. So, you know, if I read my kid's story, which isn't rhyming, then I would say the first line and then expect them to say the rhyming word because it would rhyme. So it's kind of, that's a useful musical... feature,
yes.
Rhyming to then assist with words through the something sounds good about rhyming, isn't it?
Yes, well, because it's got a musical structure.
Yeah,
it sort of says, oh yeah, the last phrase and this phrase, they're connected.
Yeah.
Do you know? And there's a certain repetition in the rhyme that says, oh yeah, there's a structure, there's a beat, there's a tempo, there's a rhythm.
Yeah,
do you know? So So poetry is very close to music.
Yeah.
It's an in between. It's language put. It's language and music again. You know, blended in a way that we find pleasing, and we like.
Yeah.
You know, we do like.
Mm.
If we start to listen, we like to play. You know, and extend a certain word.
Yeah.
We do sing a little bit, and I used to do this. Sometimes you can just listen to somebody's voice and it can be like a song. You know, you can detune from the meaning of the words and just listen to the way that it changes. You know, it's not all I was just saying that when I hear what we would say the Latin languages, they seem to have a lot more going on. A lot more.
It's really hard if you're an English speaking person to tune out from the meaning of the words, so you can hear the shape of other languages when you don't know. You can have your idea of what French sounds like.
Yeah, because I don't know what someone's saying.
We
don't
know what we sound like because we just focus.
But even then, if I try to speak a French accent, you know, I'm going all over the place. You know, you start to enter into even impersonating the language. You think, oh gosh, but my ordinary speaking is pretty flat. I mean, it's not quite, you know. But I wouldn't go that high ordinarily. You know, it's my pitch range is, it does change, but it's not quite as strong as it would be if I was, you know, when I was in France, I find that if I can't speak French, it helps a lot if I start to sing in English, you know, within in a French way. Generally, it goes down better.
So we need some non-English speakers to do impressions of English people in made-up language to know what we sound like.
Yeah, well, yeah, although I'm sounding a little Eastern European now. All right. So the music comes first. So we're talking about newborn infants can distinguish the timbre and intonation of their mother's voice. They prefer it to any other. And could distinguish the unique intonation of their mother tongue, a telling phrase, which they prefer to others. Ultimately, music is the communication of emotion, says McGilchrist here. Of course, we always have to watch this, don't we? At a certain point, there's something about the brain. It just sort of opens up and says, "Oh, just tell me how it is." You know, it's a fine line keeping a critical stance to something and. Especially if you agree with it. I just noticed that. Ultimately, music is a communication. Suddenly said, "Is it? Who says?" But well, anyway, let's put that to one side. The most fundamental form of communication, which in again, phylogeny, or phylogeny.
What does it mean, John?
Well, ontogeny is the way that you change. Or develop in an individual lifetime, and phylogeny is the way that the species changes. So that's saying that the species developed musical communication first, and then developed language. That's the phylogeny, and the ontogeny is that, but in an individual life, you start singing first as a baby and then develop language. And it's taken to be evidence, if you like, that the phylogeny follows the ontogeny, that it would have been we would have been musical first because that's the way that the
so does that also necessitate
that I do mean the other way around, yes.
And does that also because if you follow that necessitates death as well, isn't it? The individual dies, the species has to die.
Yeah.
Are we heading this
well,
way
I think everybody's agreed on that unless we get some unless this. Well, we may be the exception when we develop our eternal machines, you know, when we our dreadful futures, artificial intelligences that you know, don't need any food or oxygen anymore, just need a bit of sunlight to power their solar panels and drift around in space. Let's not go there. But it may be that we escape from that. Fate. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people. What's his name? Kurzweil.
Yeah.
Kurzweil. You know, he couldn't just. He's one of the guys at the forefront of artificial intelligence. I mean, I'm on tape here. I only wish he'd listened to me. You know, he was so upset. He couldn't accept his father's death, so he's searching to become immortal. He thinks that artificial intelligence is going to somehow stop something like his father dying. I think really at a deep level where you what you do is often informed by a trauma. It seemed like Kurzweil's trauma was his death of his father, and he wants to get rid of death by building machines that we can. He wants to upload his brain into a computer, and then you've seen the sci-fi movies, but there are people with serious financial backing who are planning this for the human race, you know. Oh well, once such a machine is built, you know, we can upload people very easily, whether they'll be conscious or not. Is the difficult question. So ultimately, music is the communication of emotion, blah, blah, blah. Neurological research strongly supports the assumption that our love of music reflects the ancestral ability of our mammalian brain to transmit and receive basic emotional sounds. And music was built upon prosodic mechanisms of the right hemisphere. that allow us effective emotional communications through vocal intonations. Presumably such mechanisms were highly important for group survival. All right, so the gist being there, of course, that this broader attention that we've paid to our social environment and our ability to sing and keep track of the song.
How is that different from what animals do?
How is what different?
Sorry, I can't see it very well because you're in the way, but what he's just said?
Well, only that we've developed longer pieces of music.
Yeah, animals communicate their emotions through sounds.
Yes.
And these are highly important for the group.
Yes.
So they can communicate.
Yeah.
They're scared of
a particular
creature.
Yes. We're not saying that there's a cut-off saying language starts here. We're just saying that ability of the mammalian brain has got extended in us. You might say that our music has become, you know, animal sounds are episodic.
Is that whales sing?
Yes, mm-hmm. Whales and dolphins have come up as examples of.
And birds.
Well, I mean, I think the most complex bird I've listened to is a nightingale, and it's clearly not singing in the way that the dolphins and whales do. I think they're at another level in terms of what they're communicating. Again, that's just my own experience. I think there are other birds that have more complex communications, but I think we're just looking at back to Maturana and Verd and Soller, the coordination of behaviour, that we started to sing in such a way as it started to change our behaviour, in that it enabled us to come together and coordinate our actions in ways that we couldn't do before. But you see, we're reconstructing all of this in hindsight. So I guess we're saying, because we already have it in nature, that the whales are able to, and the dolphins are able to, coordinate themselves through song when they're hunting. And so we're assuming in a way that other mammals don't exhibit that except ourselves, and we've gone beyond that sort of singing together, but we would assume that that early singing would be a way of coordinating behaviour. And as our brains developed, the sophistication of that coordination developed.
Yeah, but we lost. But what we lost was the emotional release of the music when we kind of left it behind.
Yes.
So if you look at the thing you mentioned in the, you know, when you got more basic societies in Africa where they still sing on as part of the kind of.
Ooh,
relationship, not coming as a choir to sing, it's completely like embedded without it even being have to be defined.
Well, you see, you didn't do Sufi dancing, did you? Back in the day.
Yeah.
Back in the day, we used to happen here, didn't it, in Brighton? We used to go Sufi dancing. Well, no, not whirling. It was just a thing it wasn't. Proper Sufi dancing, actually. It was just a bunch of us used to get together and dance and sing, but in a structured way, you know, a bit like they do it with the you know, country dancing, you know, but with more spiritual content to the songs. Yeah, I'm tempted to start, you know, but I won't. But that was my very early on in my life, in my 20s, that was my introduction to singing together, you know, just wandering in a room with a bunch of people you never met before, and what next minute you're standing in front of somebody just singing, and they're singing back to you, and you haven't had to say, oh, hello, you know, what do you do? I'm a very nervous young man, you know. You, there's no room for that. You're just singing and looking into someone else's eyes, and you think, this is nice. You know, it's Nicolette didn't like it so much. Nicolette hated it, actually. So it's not for everyone, but for me, I thought, oh, how lovely, you know, what a lovely way to be together. It just cuts through. You suddenly see what language is. It's a way of keeping you over there, you know, or it can be. Well, for me, actually singing as a form of being with somebody is something else. We don't do it, do we? I mean, at a disco, you don't. You're kind of still. You're in your own sort of space with the music.
It's a really good concert that you're really enjoying with other people.
Yes. But I, unfortunately, concerts for me, I just hate being with other people.
Like rugby matches, football matches, together, or terraces.
And I remember it as a teenager. Yeah. I see David
Especially
Bowie and
all
that.
Oh, yeah. Well, just hearing the stadium when you're at Sussex and there's a match on, and some roar occurs there, you think, oh, that's powerful.
Rolling Stones, you know, it's quite an atmosphere in the day.
It's community expression, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's
what's quite
nice. Electric joy.
Yeah, I've been to so many football matches of late, but I went to see an Arsenal game, which the new ground is known as the Library, because they're so quiet. But Liverpool were playing that day, and you heard what would be the remnants of the Kop or something, and it was majestic, because you could really hear the songs, and because they're doing really well at the moment, I mean, it really is like there's an outpouring. And it's for places that I suppose that might, in terms of their identity, they've gone through such a hard time, haven't they, on Merseyside,
mm-hmm.
Thatcher,
and
shipbuilding, all the rest, the place has transformed, but they've still held on to something of their roots, and it is conveyed in songs that there'll be a shared collective that will express it. Just like at Everton, they have their own songs, but it's there. It is very powerful when you hear it, in terms of that. And it's the same with rugby and thinking about the Welsh singing. There is something there.
Yes, but there's I think the kind of singing that we're talking about here that would be occurring just in a family group is more like the Sufi dancing. It's more like just really connecting with somebody and saying, I'm so pleased to be here, or I'm not, you know, or whatever. But you're doing it in a way where all the words aren't there. The very way you're feeling and what you're conveying is one with the sound coming out of you. You know, that words let that separation get in between your inner state. They don't have to, but you can use words to dissimulate how you are inside.
I also use
probably people could learn to sing that way though as well.
I mean, singing's quite visceral, and I mean, you know, if you're kind of going on if you do the walk up thing, you know, it's a good way of getting grounded before fighting, and you stamp down into the ground, feel your energy push down, and you make a noise.
Yeah.
And I remember when I used to get women started on this, who used to go around in a big circle going, ugh, ugh, you know, this kind of thing. I couldn't get them to stop. I'd go, right, that's enough now. And they'd go, oh, we want to carry on, because it feels very good. But that's more about something else, I think.
Well, I'm reminded of when Nicolette's...
It's not just specific stuff and sweet and lovely stuff, it's also something quite aggressive as well.
Yes, the Maoris... in Australia.
And the Harkers.
Nicolette was looking after, you know, in her palliative care, and I was in the car park at a funeral where they did that haka in the wherever, you know, the crematorium, and that was because of because it was a funeral. It expressed something of a total tribal solidarity that was said. There's no individual anymore. If we have to go and die, we'll just go as this. You know, you could see that, you could feel there was a unity in it that transcended the individual. You know, that that was, and you could see if you were on the other side of it, you wouldn't want to be facing it. Do you know? Yeah, there's a hole, you know, and I'm sure that there are aspects. We're not saying that our family units who were in their loving harmony together were feeling that for the others over the way. You know, it's not. When we're looking at that loving place in Maturana and Verdenzola, we're also looking at that there's hostility, of course.
But that does exist in the married people now. I mean, I've been in the married families in the West, you know, in Australia, and there definitely is that family is very strong. The married family is, it's cute, you know, and you go in the home and there is everybody's there, you know, all around the place, living in the West, you know, not living in New Zealand, but living in Australia. And it's a real sense of the family. Really, kind of, you know, the big guys and the women are quite big, you know, children. And it's like walking into it, you know.
Yeah.
It's just like walking into it, and everybody's connected to everybody else. It's quite different to us here.
Yeah, quite very, very strong culture, and Yes, interesting to see something that's so strong and still alive like that in the midst of, you know, suburban Australia. It's quite incongruous.
Yeah.
I'm going to... Shall we? I think we should have a little break.
Yeah.
Yes.